President Trump gave Iran 48 hours to comply with his demands to open the Strait of Hormuz, or holy hell was going to be unleashed. Well, but then that got pushed back. No, actually, it's 5 days. 5 days, and then it's going to be holy hell is going to, you know what? No, how about this? How about we say 10 days this time? Let's go with 10 days. As per Iranian government request, please let this statement serve as represent that I am pausing a period of energy plant destruction by 10 days to Monday, April 6th at 8 p.m. Interesting, he puts the exact time on there. Don't worry about the fake news. They don't know what they're talking about. Thank you for your attention to this matter, he always weirdly says, President Donald J. Trump. Well, I'm not sure what to make out of that, but somebody that I know who does, because he has all the answers, and somebody we're very grateful to have back on, is Matthew Ho, coming to us from Phoenix, Arizona today. Matt, welcome back to the show, and boy, are we looking forward to all the right answers.
Right, exactly. I thanks for having me back on, Danny. I think he's a showman, right? He knows how to give the audience what they want. He knows how to tease, right? He knows that you don't, on the first episode of the season, you don't give away the whole plot. You don't give away the whole ending. You know, you got to slowly reel these things out. This is the idea that he is a ringmaster, which is something that we heard a lot of in his first term, not so much this term, but this analogy or this allusion to being a ringmaster, I think is true. And I think he's going with his instincts here to play people along, to reel out some line, to give people a show. You see that by his constant public statements, even though he contradicts himself all over. And I think that gets to the core of this, is that he's not doing this because of this, meaning this war, and in larger foreign policy issues as well. But he's not doing this because he has some type of conviction or some type of belief or some type of principles that he's following. He's doing this because this is what he feels is best for himself. He feels that for enriching himself through Kushner and Witkoff's work, keeping himself in the best graces of Miriam Adelson and the Israeli lobby, keeping all the CEOs and shareholders at Raytheon and Lockheed, and of course ExxonMobil and the natural gas companies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, happy. That makes him happy. And so that's the way I really view this. There are certainly those around him who see this war as having purposes other than that. But for Donald Trump, I think this war really is a reflection of his own self-interest, his own ego. And so by extension, then this constant pronouncement of we're winning or we're going to do this or we're giving him 5 days or 10 days. I mean, I tell you what, man, if this was a TV show, if this was like a Netflix show, I'd watch it. You know, I wouldn't miss an episode. What's this guy going to do next? You know, but unfortunately,
really keep him with the Netflix version of events here. If you watch the episode yet, I mean, the news yesterday in not the Oval Office, but the White House during the cabinet meeting, one of the co-stars, Pete Hegseth, put on a masterful performance. Watch this.
A-10 Warthogs, if you know them, you love them, and Apache helicopter gunships are flying strike missions inside Iranian airspace and throughout the Strait of Hormuz at will. See, you only send these slow, low-flying, close air support platforms when the enemy has no meaningful air defenses left. Their presence is proof that Iran's air defenses are gone. Their command and control is shattered, their top leaders hiding in underground bunkers, while their mid-level commanders are being crushed in the field, the morale of their fighters plummeting. We see that disconnect daily.
Now, of course, I don't know that he really should have had his script on the table as right. He's contemporaneously speaking. That was a little bit weird, even for the showmanship of the White House. But man, we got to talk about, I mean, first of all, just talk about that performance at face value. And then we're going to talk about how that compares to what's actually going on the ground. More on that in a second. But first of all, give me your Rotten Tomatoes impression of that.
You know, I whenever I see him speak and I see him doing these performances and also, too, he brings in the religion into it as well. I mean, he makes these statements about having no mercy, you know, and that God should destroy the wicked and, you know, smash their teeth and all these Old Testament illusions that he brings in. But Hegseth reminds me, and I think you'd agree, Danny, and the other men and women in the audience who've been in the military, he would have been the type of officer that the Lance Corporals or the specialists loved, because he spoke this way, he acted this way, he acted like somebody you'd see on an Instagram reel or right. But then when you're actually in combat, he's the kind of guy who's going to roll off the fob with four vehicles and only come back with three. You know, I mean, there is a performance here that essentially covers up for a lack of competence, right? You know, there is a display going on, this the language, the references to biblical destruction, the praise of all our almighty aircraft, you know, et cetera. And, you know, it's covering up for a complete lack of performance, of competence, of ability. I mean, I don't know if you saw the article yesterday but supposedly the Pentagon is scrambling to move concrete bunkers over to the Middle East, that we started this war without having the adequate force protection for our troops. I mean, after, you know, we knew that Iran was going to utilize missiles and drones as their primary weapon, almost solely as the only weapon. And yet we started this war without having the needed bunkers in place to protect our soldiers and our Marines and our sailors and our airmen, you know, and our Space Force personnel. I mean, it's just that's what you get when you have a guy who's dressed like Hegseth with his slick back hair, doing all the videos. You know, you see all these promotional propaganda videos that are really high production value coming out. And then you look at across the board how unprepared our military was for this war, how it was put in a war where they didn't have objectives to meet, clear objectives to meet, a strategy for which to pursue those objectives. And of course, they are up against a timeline that favors Iran, and that day by day, the U.S. forces grow more hollow, right? I mean, and particularly when it comes to our munitions. So, yeah, I mean, you look at Hegseth and you're just, I mean, my thing is just the disgust. I mean, I knew officers like him in the Marine Corps, I'm sure you did as well, Danny, in the Army, who were like this, who were all mouth, like they're all show. And when it came down to it, they couldn't actually execute anything. Yeah, and that's what we're seeing here with this. And of course, the danger is.
I saw one particular combat, this certain officer was all mouth in the garrison. And then when he got into the conflict, he was all in the rear, was hardly even on the radio at all. He was the commander. I have a lot of experience with that. Let's take a look though at what that translates into in real life, because I mean, number one, this is news out just today. Is that now we're up to 303 that have been wounded, and they try to say, well, they're not that serious. It's not that big a deal. Yeah. 13 are dead. And 10 are seriously wounded, but most of them are fine. They're going to get back in, but that number keeps going up. It went from 200, then to 240, and they keep releasing it in increments. And now here we're up to 300. But towards what end? So, because so far we haven't done anything at all except we're in bunkers. And obviously, as you just pointed out there, we don't have enough air defense capability to intercept incoming missiles. And then when the missiles that get through, we don't have enough ground protection. And so people keep getting wounded in these. And it seems like it's just a matter of time before that death count keeps going up. And these guys are just sitting on the ground. I mean, we're not even doing anything. Why are we losing American troops and having people seriously wounded for something we don't even know what we're doing?
Right. I mean, one is it's just simply we weren't prepared. Two, it's because the Iranians are targeting pieces of equipment. They're not going after our forces. I mean, we could see that through either satellite imagery, or now we're seeing some of these first-person drone videos coming out of, say, Iraq. They're targeting specifically materiel. They're targeting communications, command and control systems, radars, you know, those sorts of things that our troops aren't present with. They're not targeting the barracks, so to speak, although from what we understand, there's hardly anyone on these bases anymore. You wonder if is there any headquarters activity going on in Bahrain at Fifth Fleet headquarters? And the same thing for Central Command. Has everything been evacuated back to NATO bases in Europe? or even back to Florida, because these positions in the Middle East are untenable. The Americans can't maintain them. And so now you start looking into this question of who's running this thing? Who are the generals and admirals who are supposed to be looking at the big picture of it all? What have they been doing for the last 15 years? This type of warfare is not new. This is what should have been expected. And the same goes for whether you're looking at warfare through the Middle East or especially in the last 4 years with Russia and Ukraine. You know, so why were these bases even maintained? Why do we have this posture that we can't use for war fighting? We have all these bases throughout the Middle East, and they are no good for war fighting. They have to be evacuated. And then it has become a propaganda reel for the Iranians showing how much it destroyed. And of course, there was that big New York Times story this week that said 13 U.S. bases in the region are uninhabitable. Yeah, Gary's put that up there.
Yeah. And then this is the one right here.
This gets to big questions, Danny, about stuff that you and I have talked about for a long time, going back to 2009 when we first met, we were talking about this stuff. But this idea of that the leadership at the highest levels of the U.S. military is incapable of accepting the reality of the world. They're incapable of reading what the actual situation is with regards to America's adversaries, as well as America's own ability to fight wars, whether it's be our actual forces or our industrial production to support them. And yeah, I mean, so you look at this from top to bottom and you see the United States military just as a superficial shell that Pete Hegseth essentially serves as a really good characterization for, right? But Pete Hegseth is a great personification for the U.S. military, all talk and very little substance, right? Very little delivery. And I say one thing, too, about the number of wounded. I would say wound number one is 500 because you had 200 sailors who suffered injuries aboard the Ford when they were trying to put out that fire, which that fire itself, whatever the cause of it is. And if you look at the history of the Ford, you'll see that it most likely was some type of accident. But even if it was, say, sabotage, how come it took 30 hours for an American warship to put out a fire? One, design the ships are essentially designed around damage control, particularly fire suppression. What happened? Why couldn't this ship do what it needed to do to contain a fire? And then the other half of that is this is what the crew is supposedly doing constantly to be prepared for. And the crew couldn't contain a fire for 30 hours. So now you're looking at this $13 billion aircraft carrier that wasn't designed with damage control in mind and a crew that is either exhausted, untrained, poorly led, et cetera, that couldn't contain that fire for 30 hours. I mean, again, that example of the Ford and whether it was because, you know, some kid was angry, he wasn't going to get home, so he lit a fire, or that someone just left too much lint in the dryer or something like that. You know, what you have here is, again, another great example of the larger problems with the U.S. military and why this war is essentially the best thing the U.S. can do is declare victory and go home. But whether or not the Iranians actually would agree to that is a whole other question to ask.
And actually, I'm glad you brought that point up because there's a real confusion going on in the U.S. government because you have the one hand, the cheerleaders like Pete Hegseth, Lindsey Graham, Jack Keane. I mean, they just keep on saying, yeah, man, let's go. And then there's a little bit of realism starting to sneak in a little bit. Let's go down that path first. I want to show you here is Nancy Mace, Representative Mace, on CNN a couple of days ago, talking about her concern that we may be about to go in on the ground.
Was it the information that you were receiving or the lack of information that you were receiving?
It's
was
both.
A distinction?
I would say that it's both. And I would say that you saw Republicans across the spectrum today express their frustration. You saw Republicans and Democrats alike. I was not convinced when I walked out of there that troops on the ground were necessary to declare victory. But I have a hard time understanding what Karg Island has to do with some of our objectives.
So now that's somebody who's in many respects quite loyal to the President Trump, and to have her go on CNN at that and make those statements, and she's been making them quite a bit even on social media. What do you make about the unified front, so to speak, politically of President Trump or his ability to rally everybody to make them think it is necessary?
Well, we saw the Senate vote down the War Powers Resolution this week with one Democratic defection, John Fetterman. Otherwise, it was along party lines. Oh, no, I guess Rand Paul also voted against it from the Republican side, if I recall correctly. But you have the War Powers Resolution, the Democrats saying we're not going to reintroduce it in the House. We're going to go on vacation for 2 weeks, and then we'll do the War Powers Resolution when we get back. So according to the Democratic Party, going on their recess, taking their vacation, getting back to shake hands and collect checks from wealthy constituents is the priority for the party, not this war. I mean, so I think it's a good question for anyone who might bump into a member of Congress, is particularly from the House. Why? What else is more important for a member of Congress to do than to vote on war? But you're seeing these cracks within the Republican Party. We have to remember that George W. Bush maintained party loyalty on Iraq for years, and even the major Democrats who defected, such as John Murtha, that wasn't until about almost 2 years after the war began. This fact that you see people like Nancy Mace, or even too, you had the chairs of the House Armed Services Committee and the Senate Armed Services Committee this week, Wicker and Rogers, come out and say, we're not getting enough information. And one of the two said, if this administration doesn't start giving us more information, he's going to lose support of the Republican caucus. You're just seeing, again, another example of a White House that has, begun a war that not only is unwinnable, but also, too, that they didn't prepare for, it seems like, in any meaningful way, including even to have the messaging to ensure that their own party remains loyal to the president's actions here. It really is quite staggering. And you see that, too. I think one of the comments that Nancy Mace had made was that, what she was told in the these closed door briefings in terms of what the U.S. objectives are is not what she has seen publicly stated by the administration. So a month into this war, the United States government, the White House, still doesn't have clear objectives for this war. And you saw this past week, Danny, the publishing of the 15-point surrender plan, essentially from Iran, which is actually longer, which basically says everything that we were saying to Iran before we started attacking Iran, with the exception of adding on a couple things, because now you have the Straits of Hormuz closed. So, I think anyone who is looking at this, who, if you were, say, renovating your house and you have specific goals in mind, I'm going to do the kitchen, and at some point you realize as you're renovating, because of your renovation efforts, you now have to do your bathroom. I think it's time to stop what you're doing and get out of that situation, because now we have essentially demands being put or objectives being stated by the White House that didn't exist 4 weeks ago. This war is what closed the Straits of Hormuz. So this idea that now it's one of the objectives is Iran has to open the Straits of Hormuz, is just anyone who's looking at this is saying, this is insane. Your actions caused this. Stop digging the hole you're in.
Yeah. So, and interesting you bring that up, because that was Representative Nancy Mace in the House. Well, a Republican senator on the other chamber here has a different view. Now, when I say Senator Kennedy, you're probably already going to start rolling your eyes, because he's so bombastic and always has these, clever quips to say and these colloquialisms, et cetera. I want you to, as you listen to what he's saying here, watch his body language, which is really different than you're normally used to seeing from him.
As far as I'm concerned, it's time to come home. Now, I don't have the information the president has. And some will say, well, you caused a blockade of the Strait of Hormuz. No, we didn't. Iran did that. We can't control these people. And I would come out.
How soon? How soon do you want to see that?
Well,
happen?
I can't answer that, because I don't know to what extent we've accomplished our mission. But I was seeing some news stories this morning that are showing, apparently based on information from Defense Department of War, I guess they call it now, that we're almost there, if not there, in some.
I thought he was going to start crying at the end of that, but he seems really confused and really, really perplexed and then just kind of falls back on, I guess, talking points. Oh, well, you know, as it turns out, we're nearly there. I mean, we've almost accomplished everything militarily, whatever that is. But what do you make of his tepidness, but also we need to get out?
Yeah, that's not the Senator Kennedy that we know from Louisiana. I mean, usually he's a staple of the cable news programs because he usually is pretty reliable in being passionate, right? And saying things that are going to get people excited, you know? And here you see like a man who acting like he just got out of the hospital, you know, in terms of just like not having the energy to even fake support for this war. You're seeing it too in other ways. I saw some of the statements that came out from some of the Republican senators who voted against the War Powers Resolution this week in the Senate. And, you know, now a lot of the defense of it is the fact that Iran supposedly fired two longer range missiles at, you know, our base in Diego Garcia. And of course, there's no proof of that. We're just essentially the media is taking the word of the Americans and the Israelis for that. There's no proof whatsoever. But that excuse is now the apology for Republicans. I saw Senator Katie Britt from Alabama. That was essentially what her statement was, saying why she voted, you know, against the War Powers Resolutions, why she's supporting this war, because Iran has these missiles that can reach Diego Garcia, which they actually didn't. And we don't even know, again, if they were real or not. You know, so I think we're going to see this continuation of coming up with reasons for this war. You know, Senator Kennedy is going on about how we didn't close the Straits of Hormuz. It's our war that closed the Straits of Hormuz. You're saying we have to continue this war until the Straits of Hormuz are open, when it's the war that closed the Straits of Hormuz. I mean, there's such an absurdity here, a Kafka-esque aspect to this, just in a logic. You know, and same thing too with, say, Senator Britt saying it's because of these long range. Or now you're also seeing the Europeans saying that. This is certainly what Kaya Kallas is saying, Mark Rutte is saying, you know, the foreign minister of the EU, as well as the secretary general of NATO, that this is the reason for the war, because Iran has shown that it has missiles that can reach Diego Garcia, again, unproven. But, you know, I mean, this is all okay, but that wasn't presented 4 weeks ago when this war was launched. You're just continuing to add reasons in here that are the consequences of this war. And, you know, how does it ever end then? Let alone, how do you actually know if you've actually accomplished anything? Because you have no objectives. You have nothing to base success upon. And, you know, I think, again, it's just the administration thought this was going to be easy. They thought it was going to be like Venezuela, or they were so gobsmacked, so overwhelmed with, as a friend of mine says, so high on their own gaslighting, that they believed in the capacity of the American military to do just whatever it wished, like it was some type of superhuman or supernatural force.
Yeah, I can confirm to you, I can tell you that for sure, that there were those at the highest levels of the inside of the administration, which I found out actually just today, that there was a belief that, like Venezuela, we could do whatever we wanted here and that it would be over soon. And I want to show you some, I want to show our audience here how things have shifted. So you say that there wasn't a plan. There was a plan. I'm sorry, that there wasn't a set of objectives. There was one that President Trump made on 28 February when he first announced this in public. Watch this.
The United States military is undertaking a massive and ongoing operation to prevent this very wicked, radical dictatorship from threatening America and our core national security interests. We are going to destroy their missiles and raise their missile industry to the ground. It will be totally, again, obliterated. We are going to annihilate their navy. We are going to ensure that the region's terrorist proxies can no longer destabilize the region or the world and attack our forces and no longer use their IEDs or roadside bombs, as they are sometimes called, to so gravely wound and kill thousands and thousands of people, including many Americans. And we will ensure that Iran does not obtain a nuclear weapon.
So, in short, he says that our objectives on the first hours were destroy their missile capacity, destroy their navy, end their support for proxies, and, of course, get rid of the nuclear weapons program. We now know that we cannot obliterate the missile program because it's buried not just in underground missile cities, but spread throughout the country in a decentralized fashion, so you can't just knock it out. And now then Iran is demonstrating actively with a sustained rate of fire that they're hitting into both Israel and UAE and several other places around. And this whole thing about the Navy, now people say, oh, but they got 94% of the Navy. That's the claim. The reality is that there are over anywhere between, depending on who's doing the counting, I guess, between 3,000 and 5,000 of these speedboats that can launch missiles, and hardly any of those have even been touched because most of them are underground. So we haven't destroyed. We destroyed their old conventional Navy that was in ports, and that was easy to do. And, of course, the proxies. Now we have with the Khatib Hezbollah in Iraq, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and potentially the Houthis in the Yemen are now all getting into the fight in one form or another. So that's expanding, not reducing. And then, of course, there's the issue of the nuke program. Now, we allegedly, and this is according to Tulsi Gabbard in Senate testimony a couple of days ago, said that, it was obliterated last year in Operation Midnight Hammer, their facilities to have nuclear weapons. But then there's the issue of this 400 kilograms. Mm-hmm. Which I have it on good authority was spread to at least 3 different locations inside of Iran and makes it nearly impossible to go get. You can't have this. Well, some people may try more in that minute to go get it, but right now we don't have access to it. So none of those tactics have been, none of those objectives have been met. And it's now nearly impossible after 10,000 targets have been struck, according to CENTCOM. And you see that it has not done anything on any of those. Where do we go from here if none of your objections or none of your objectives can be met?
As well, too, this objective of regime change, which they either want regime change or they don't want regime change, depending upon which day, but no real plan for it. I mean, you had Donald Trump in the first weekend of this war saying that we had a plan. We had people who we had picked to succeed and take over the Iranian government, but we killed them all. I mean, just this is idiotic, and this, the whole idea too, I think, with regards to having objectives such as destroying the missile program, it's impossible. How are you going to destroy some country's missile program unless you physically occupy the country and burn every machine shop to the ground, right? As that will then line up everyone who's got knowledge on how to build missiles and rockets and that type of technology, and either imprison them or kill them, and then essentially make sure no one could ever learn that information again. I mean, it's just absurd, you know. And the Iranians themselves have said this over and over again, with regards to the nuclear technology, in particular. It's knowledge. How do you destroy knowledge? You can never do anything unless we agree to not build a weapon, which they have for decades now, and which President Obama had got them to sign a pledge not to. How do you get rid of that knowledge? I mean, so it's one thing that say you have objectives. It's another thing, then, of course, to see what we've seen where the objectives get contradicted over the weeks. But the important thing about objectives are that they're clear and that they're attainable, that there's actually a strategy that you can put in place that will achieve that objective. You know, so essentially, if you don't want Iran to have missiles capable of hitting, you know, whatever range is, then you have to get into some type of political agreement with them, with some type of diplomatic agreement with them, where they agree through a treaty not to build these weapons. And maybe that was the path that they thought, that they were going to essentially take out the Iranian leadership. There would be a Venezuela-style a change in the government, essentially a turnkey operation, and that these new Iranian leaders who have been elevated from subordinate positions would simply agree to the demands of the Americans, just as what we've seen happen in Venezuela, where, you know, Nicolas Maduro was kidnapped, Delcy Rodriguez, his vice president, became president, and, you know, the Venezuelan government is agreeing to everything the Americans want. Oh, yeah, we'll change our petroleum laws. We'll, you know, do this thing, that thing. We'll let these people out of prison. So I think that was the expectation with this administration for Iran, which I think anyone who spent more than a few hours of their lives studying Iran, maybe you've read a couple books about it, you would know that that's simply not going to happen with that country. It's just different than Venezuela. So, I mean, Danny, I remember years ago getting caught up in this compare and contrast. And I'm sure you had the same thing too, right? Where people would ask you, well, you know, what's different between Iraq and Afghanistan? You know, what's it? And you get caught up and you start talking about the terrain or the modern history or whatever. And then you have the realization that the only thing that matters is the American occupation. And I think in this case, we can talk about Venezuela, we can talk about Iran, we can try and compare them. But the reality is the only thing that matters is this administration and who's leading it and how they're going to act. And yeah, they got lucky with Venezuela.
They did. They got lucky.
Their own hubris, their own ego propelled them into this war, as well as their stupidity and naivety, their ability to be pushed by the Israelis into something, right? Their beholdenness to other institutions, whether that be Israel or to ExxonMobil or to whoever. Yeah. And so I think, you know, here we are with this realization that we're stuck in this war. Because the people leading this war are Donald Trump, Pete Hegseth, Marco Rubio, J.D. Vance, you know, the worst of the absolute worst. And how does this war end then?
And going back to that, especially to the Trump portion of this, let me show you, that was Trump on the opening day. 4 weeks later, last night on Fox, he was asked a question that a lot of people have been asking and have been a little surprised on my part that not as many people had been, and asked the whole issue of, President Trump ran on no wars, that he was going to get out of the wars we had, and he's done none of those. And now then he's escalated beyond anybody's imagination. And so far, at least the polls are saying that at least of his core supporters, they haven't left him over it. And now some have, but apparently significant portions, like 91%, are still with him on this. Last night on Fox News, the anchor asked President Trump on a phone interview, what do you say to those people who said this is against what you campaigned for?
Let's say they voted for you on the assumption of no wars, and then this happens and it's inconsistent with their wishes. What would you say to them?
Well, I have to do something in terms of making America great and keeping America great. And when you have lunatics with nuclear weapons and the power is beyond belief, I will tell you, as a president, I get to see it. My uncle was a great professor at MIT, and he knew more about nuclear at the time than anybody. He told me stories that were horrible in terms of the power, both beautiful in terms of putting it to good use, but really bad for destruction purposes.
And by the way, he just rambled on and on and on about his uncle and a bunch of stuff that had literally no point to this. And of course, he went on to something else. That's not even related. And I'd like your view on the one thing he did say, which was, yeah, I know I said that, but I have to keep nuclear weapons out of the hands of crazy people. Is that valid?
No, it's not valid because, one, they didn't have nuclear weapons. The leader of Iran, the Ayatollah Khamenei, had issued a fatwa, a religious order, a religious decree. The weight of constitutional authority in Iran, basically saying that nuclear weapons and weapons of mass destruction in general are forbidden, that they're un-Islamic, they're ungodly, and this country will not partake in those weapons. And then we killed that guy. You know what I mean? So you also had, you know, just the fact that since 2003, the American intelligence community has consistently said Iran is not building a nuclear weapon. You've had the Israeli intelligence folks say the same thing. You had the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the treaty that Barack Obama, the British, the Germans, the French, the Chinese, the Russians entered into with Iran in 2015, where Iran pledged not to build any nuclear weapons, not to enrich the uranium above a certain threshold, to allow for inspections and for verification, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you had, just on one hand, the very real, genuine authority presented by the Iranian government that we're not going to build these, and evidence that they had never had, confirmed by American and Israeli intelligence services. And then you also saw the willingness of the Iranians to negotiate and enter into a deal that Donald Trump ripped up in his first term, abrogated solely by the United States, that treaty, because John Bolton told him to. Right. I mean, like, you know, so just as well as the fact that the Iranians, you know, and shame on them for doing it so often, but were willing to enter into negotiations with the Americans. And now you've seen a country like Iran that has been dedicated to principle, dedicated to a plan. Doesn't mean you have to support the Iranian government. You know, I mean, classify people as enemies of God. It's, you know, not my thing, you know, but, you know, at least in terms of your foreign relations with that country, the Iranians mean what they say. And then so when you see, then I think this is what's so dangerous, Danny, is the strategic patience of the Iranians, their willingness to go through diplomacy, their willingness to go back through diplomacy, their willingness to endure cyber attacks, sabotage, assassinations, bombings in their country for years carried out by the U.S. and the Israelis. You see two iterations of conflict with Israel and Iran in 2024. Then, of course, a 12-day war last year.
Yeah.
And, you know, all through that, Iran is saying, you know, we are willing to negotiate. If we see this conflict as only temporary, we don't see this as a war. And then now this year, the Iranians have said, no, this is total war. And we are not going to end this war until our objectives are achieved. And those objectives very clearly are, you know, the establishment or the confirmation or the protection of their sovereignty and the establishment of deterrence in the region. And the Iranians are saying, we're not going to stop this war until we achieve that.
Well, and that is the problem here. And in the last bit of time we have here, we titled this the deadlines for escalation. And it now appears that we're on the cusp of that, because what we've been doing isn't working. Despite all the happy talk that was coming out of the cabinet meeting yesterday about how we've basically obliterated and we have controlled the skies, A-10s and all this kind of stuff. Yeah. The reality on the ground is very different. And evidence suggests that we have already had about 10,000 troops on the ground. That's Marines, 82nd Airborne Division, and some special forces army troops. Another 10,000 are apparently being alerted, headed down there. And you have the likes of Mark Levin here, who says, look, you cannot remove all of the highly enriched uranium nuclear grade in Iran without going into the tunnels and underground to get it. I don't know what the administration's plan is, but I'm guessing this is at least one reason why there are public reports that some of our special forces are being called up. And then he goes on to complain about Nancy Mace. But when you look at the 31st MEU Marine Expeditionary Unit, the 11th MEU that's heading that direction, 82nd Airborne Special Forces, et cetera, there's a number of things that could be possible, either taking Cargill, which keeps getting Nancy Mace mentioned a minute ago, but apparently that's what the administration keeps talking about, whether that's a feint or something they're actually who can say. But then this other thing that Mark Levin's talking about, others are suggesting, yeah, we can try Special Forces op to go in and get that too. As a Marine who's used to train for these kinds of things, can you tell us a little bit about what two MEUs can actually accomplish here at a tactical level? And could that, if successful, translate into operational or strategic benefit for the United States?
Well, I think what you sent there about Carg Island being a feint, I don't know if in the history of warfare anyone has ever talked about a operation like to take Carg Island so openly and broadly against a determined and capable enemy like the United States is. So possibly the fact that this administration keeps talking about Carg Island, that it would be, it's just a distraction for something else. Or maybe they really are that stupid, which with everything we've been talking here the last, you know, 35 minutes or whatever, everything we've seen, entirely a possibility. So the Marine Expeditionary Units, you're about 2,200 Marines on three ships. That forms what's called an amphibious ready group. Those MEUs or ARGs come with six either Harriers or F-35s. I think they're all F-35s now, which are incredibly limited because they're using short takeoff. So their flight time and their payload capacity is not what a typical F-35 would have. You have an ability to airlift a reinforced company off of those MEUs with the V-22s and the other helicopters that are available. So you're talking about the ability to airlift about 200 Marines total. And I should say, out of those 2,200 Marines, only about 1,000 are warfighters. The rest are either supporting the air wing that's embarked, or their logistics Marines, or their service support Marines, as they're called. So the capabilities really are pretty limited. Nobody who has any sense of anything is suggesting that the MEUs are going to, the 11th and 31st, are going to force their way through Straits of Hormuz, and you're going to conduct an amphibious landing. on the beaches of Korg Island or any other Iranian territory. Simply not possible. We can't even put our destroyers within 1,000 kilometers of Iranian coastline, let alone a troop ship. What would have to happen for these Marines then would be to fly off the ships. It'd be a long flight, 500 miles up to Korg Island, at least, probably further than that, because the Meuse would have to be held back at least several hundred miles from the Iranian coastline if we've got our destroyers and our carrier that far back. So essentially, what you'd be looking at then is disembarking the Marines in Oman, UAE, getting them to Kuwait somehow, and then staging the assault from there. And it would be an air assault. How they would use the 82nd, with the idea of jumping those guys in when we know Iran still has some degree of air defense, seems irresponsible in the least. So that's how it would work, I guess, if you're talking about taking these islands. And then the whole idea of these islands being so far removed from American bases, where's the support? Where's the reinforcement? How do you provide supply? How do you get more troops there that doesn't take a full day to get those troops there? Again, the Meuse airlift capacity is really just a reinforced company of Marines. So roughly about 200 Marines or so. Okay, it's going to take the better part of a day to get them there. How do you get them back? So again, this idea of maybe disembarking them, getting them to other places within the country. You also too have, remember that there's the other ground forces in the area, there's a brigade, National Guard Brigade, I forget from where, that's based in Kuwait, and that's mechanized infantry, which, you know, you're not going to get those guys anywhere. And what are you going to do? Have them do it? Drive through the Afal Peninsula, through the salt marshes there, you know, and their Bradleys to invade Western Iran. So the options are really pretty limited here. To get back to the Meuse, they are capable of doing a number of things. And certainly if the idea was that Iran have closed the Straits of Hormuz to everything except for their ships or other countries that are not allied with the U.S. and Israel who are willing to pay in yuan, then you could use the Marines coming off of the Meuse to interdict those ships to do.
Yeah, and let me ask you a question on that. That's something I'm really glad to have you as a Marine on here. So this right here, if you can see on the screen, this is the edge of the Iranian territory here in the Gulf of Oman. So mm-hmm. to get up even into the strait itself, up into this area here, I mean, that straight line distance is what is that? It's about 267 miles. Yeah. So tell me from this point here, if those three ships of the 31st Mew, which is the first one that's going to be on target, what is the risk to them transiting this to even get up to here to be able to insert troops if some of these are the actual target instead of Karg?
It's not possible. I mean, again, you've got the Lincoln, the carrier Lincoln, 1,100 kilometers from the Iranian coastline. Right. And she's got an entire battle group. She's got three or four destroyers dedicated to protecting her, plus her air wing. And they keep her 1,100 kilometers from the Iranian coastline. You don't have that type of protection with a Mew. You'd have to sortie other destroyers.
I'm just sorry. Let me show people. That's how far 1,100 kilometers is from the closest point to the Iranian side. This is apparently how far out our aircraft carriers, Abraham Lincoln. So they're right. Not even close enough to do anything. And there's a reason why they're this far out. But you see here, and especially on this further shot here, that Mew would have to go in through, a gauntlet of death is what I've been calling it. I mean, do you see it any different?
No. How could they? You know, and so the idea being is that you have to get them, launch them out outside of the range of Iranian, capabilities, their drones and their anti-ship missiles, get them into Oman, get them into UAE, to Kuwait, wherever. Again, that's a long haul. And I don't know, maybe they've pre-positioned more V-22s, more CH-53s and CH-47s in the area to provide further airlift. But
and
again,
for those who may not know, what is a CH-47 and CH-53?
Those are helicopters. So people familiar with the American military helicopters, these are the larger helicopters that have the two rotors, both fore and aft. And the V-22, of course, is the tilt rotor aircraft. That's the Osprey. And essentially, the V-22 was designed for this. Now, It's the practicality of it. It's maintenance issues. It's accident records.
That's a V-22 right there.
Yeah, that's a V-22 there. So it can take off vertically like a helicopter, and then the rotors go forward, and the helicopter, the plane can then fly about 300 miles an hour or so. So much faster than the helicopter with a greater range. But the problem, and then it can also refuel in the air. But again, Korg Island is many hundreds of miles from the mouth of the Strait of Hormuz, and you only got so many V-22s on a Mu. I think maybe 10 they have, and then you're going to have a couple down for maintenance maybe, as well as it's a long flight, so you can't have that thing packed, as well as how do you sustain the Marines when they're on a gun? How do you reinforce them? How do you do medevacs? And you're eventually putting these Marines, or if you jump to 82nd, in the same situations, they're incredibly light. Where's the protection? You're putting them in there, and the main threat is going to be Iranian missiles and drones that the Iranians have now prepared for this. So people are familiar with indirect fire. You know, you predetermine or you register where your fires are going to be. You know, I mean, so essentially the Iranians know that terrain. So they would know where the Marines or the paratroopers would have to go, either to assemble, to operate, to bed down, whatever. And so, I mean, the danger is here for putting troops essentially out in the open, unprotected against missiles and drones. And this is, and we've talked about this, you know, before, but, you know, this reminds me of and I can never pronounce it correctly, but the Battle of Krinki, if I'm pronouncing it right, where the Ukrainian Marines went across the river in, was it late 2023, to seize a beachhead on the other side of Kherson, and were slaughtered, absolutely slaughtered. The Russians let them come across, and then essentially for a couple months, several months, just wrecked those Ukrainian forces with drones and artillery. It was an absolute slaughter. You know, I mean, and so that's essentially what you could be seeing here. You also have large civilian populations on these islands. You know, some of the islands that are getting mentioned as well have populations of tens of thousands, or the largest island has a population of like 130,000 people on it. You're going to put how many hundreds of American troops on the ground and think it's going to work out okay? You know, I mean, so none of it makes sense in terms of who in the Pentagon would be standing briefing this and being able to do this, you know, being able to brief something like this without being laughed out of the room. But the problem is that the Iranians have the initiative. Brent oil is back over $110 a barrel today. The president is making one statement after the other. His own party is turning against him. The longer this war goes on, the better it looks for Iran. And you know, you had reports when this was reported in the Wall Street Journal this week, as well as Axios, that in addition to the 82nd elements and the Marine Expeditionary Units, they're going to send the U.S. is going to send 10,000 more soldiers. Who that's going to be, who knows? Maybe it's from the 101st or, you know, 10th Mountain or God knows what. But the, you know, the idea being was that's being presented by the administration is that this would be the final blow. So essentially what you're looking here is what can we do as a show? What can we do as a propaganda piece? What can we do to demonstrate success? And kind of goes back to what we were talking about when we opened up this program, you know, an hour ago, Danny, right? Trump as showman. So you need some spectacle. You need some Marines landing on some Iranian island someplace, or the 82nd jumping in, you know, and then planting the flag on a beach and say, we've won. And that's the visual, that's the finale. That they need to end this thing. You know, it's completely meaningless. You're putting our forces in danger for something, you know, entirely inconsequential. You know what I mean? So that's where I keep coming back to. And I think maybe it will be a distraction, this whole talk of Korg Island, because it just doesn't seem possible, let alone if you did do it and say it was successful, to what advantage do you have now?
And you're taking
Iranian oil off the market, and now Brent is no longer going to be 110. It's going to be $125 a barrel. West Texas is going to go up to 105. You know what I mean? So what's the purpose of taking Iran's oil off the off? You're just playing right into their strategy. And if people think, well, then the IRGC is going to give up because they're not getting their paychecks. you're an idiot. You don't know anything about it. Stop talking. You know, I mean, like, so, yeah. I mean, so I think maybe you'd see these Marines being used, you know, again, to interdict ships, to also to those platforms are really great platforms for Delta and SEALs to operate off of, right, for commando missions. Now you get to this really crazy thing, and God help us, why Mark Levin? You know, these are the moments where I just want to give up, right? This is where I want to go dig a hole in the woods and live in it, you know, because the fact that Mark Levin in this war or in anything is considered one of the most important commentators, I just want to give up. I really do, you know.
Listen, we're running low on time here. In the last few minutes that we have here, showmanship is not going to work for much longer. There is a time limit on this, and it's about to expire. We had Alistair Crook on this morning, who talked about a lot of details about why there's about a 3-week time level before things start falling apart. We've shown other commentators saying that some of these artificial constraints to keep oil where it has been, even at 111, as we're showing live right now, that's going to run out in just, they said, a couple of weeks. You have issues here like the U.S. national debt is already off the charts here. And then there's issues even in Asia to where a lot of the feedstocks have been going on for agriculture really all over the world, but also to make chips. It has about 2 weeks left before it starts to have a real serious impact on the global economy from that perspective. So all of these things have near-term challenges, which right now are transparent to most Americans, but they're all about to hit the fan. If we try something on the ground, that may accelerate the escalation of that. But even if we didn't and tried something, you're saying maybe it was a showmanship or something like that, that won't change that time frame here. So we are in a near-term crisis where we're going to have to do something quick, whether it's a diplomatic surrender or, God forbid us, if we try to escalate and take it up another notch. I don't see a good way out of this. What do you see?
No, I don't see either. I mean, whether it's concerns about Iran achieving dominance over the Americans and Israelis with their missiles and drones, essentially the Americans and Israelis run out of the missiles to shoot down Iranian missiles and drones, whether it is the day by day, the energy crisis is growing. The Philippines just declared a national emergency. The Asian markets run out because they get so much of their oil from the Middle East. Run out of oil before Europe does, right? And then, of course, that, you know, ripples through, and people who think that, well, it's not going to affect us, of course it is. You have issues where Qatar's natural gas is offline. And when it does come back online, their production comes back online. They're saying roughly a fifth of it will take 5 years to get back online. Qatar provides a fifth of the world's natural gas. If people don't think that has an impact on us, the United States gets 42% of its electricity generation from natural gas power plants. I mean, so essentially almost half, more than 40% of our energy production comes from natural gas. You can't have Qatar offline without that rippling. And so what you're going to have then is cost of everything goes up, right? Because energy, nothing comes to market without energy. So cost of everything goes up. At the same time, too, you're having the economic downturn, the conditions where factories start closing, production facilities start closing, and people start to get laid off. So in addition to that inflation, you have a recession, and that's what's called stagflation. And that's the worst of everything, because prices continue to go up again, because it's not a demand issue. It's a supply issue on the energy side, and there's nothing you can do about it. Right. And at the same time, too, that supply, that demand is causing such great cost to the economy, industry, manufacturers, what have you, services, that they are experiencing a downturn. They are losing revenue. Their costs are up, et cetera, et cetera. And so you have this really wicked combination where the high inflation, because it comes not from the demand side, it comes to the supply side, is now causing great harm to the productive aspects of your economy. And it just cycles on itself, right? It reinforces itself.
And the point being, you can't showmanship your way out of that one.
No, you can't.
You just can't.
No.
and we're about to find out here. But listen, running out of time right now, but I really appreciate you coming on today, man. These are some tough things, but unfortunately, this is stuff you're not getting on mainstream media. You're getting cheerleading going on the media, which is just really aggravating me. But more on that on another day. Thank you very much for coming on. We really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Danny.
And we appreciate you guys, too. We may be back to you later on this afternoon around 3:30 or so, trying to work some things out. But otherwise, we will look forward to seeing you on the next episode of the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. Don't forget to tell your friends, the ones that love to listen to podcasts. Get them to add Daniel Davis Deep Dive to their podcast list. They need to know what you know. They can get it to where they already get their podcast. You just got to tell them.